Today's show is brought to you by SunsetLakeCBD.com. This is a great company, has awesome business practices, minimum wage $15 an hour, primarily employee-owned. They practice regenerative farming practices in conjunction with the University of Vermont. Their hemp is 100% pesticide-free. They use integrated pest management to deal with pests. Their fertilizer 100% organic, and the products are amazing. I have had a tremendous success with the tinctures in terms of my sleeping. More or less, have completely eliminated my Ambien. That is a good thing. I also, for me, the Solve has been awesome for all sorts of like dry skin patches and stuff like that. But it's supposed to be for your muscles. But I use it for skin issues, but it's got CBD, it's got arnica, beeswax, and then, of course, there's the smokables. Matt loves the smalls. I've gotten great emails about the keef, and it's THC-free. It's all it's just the properties of CBD. They have CBD gummies. They have CBD-infused coffee. They make great gifts. And also you'll enjoy them yourselves. And right now, I think they're still having their sale, 25% off with promo code GIFT25. That's promo code GIFT25. Free 125 meg salve if you order $75 or more. They have a free 750 milligram tincture if you order $100 or more. And you can get both items for free if you order $125 or more. And of course, as we head into the new year, you can use their coupon code LEFTISBEST. That gets you 20% off. They're fans of the show. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Check it out. You won't be sorry you did, I promise you. Now, it is time for our program. It is Friday, January 1st, 2021.
Whoa.
My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Emma, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Can't believe we made it through that god-awful year. Wow.
If this is the last time I ever say the words 2020, I am very happy to forget that entire year. And I'm also impressed that I said 2021 correctly, because usually what happens is for the first 3 months of the year, I keep referring to the past year, but I have a feeling.
Oh, writing dates on things? I always mess up for the first 5 months, say the last year.
Now, today's last best of 2020 was, was very 2020. Shoot. I interviewed Stuart Stevens. From my perspective, probably the most sincerely regretful of their time as a Republican operative of all of the members of the Lincoln Project and of, you know, that whole Never Trumper group of people. But
so the least opportunist of the opportunist grifters of the Lincoln Project. That's how I'm characterizing it.
Yes. And you know what? I think people will see my skepticism of the entire project. And in fact, since that interview, there have been a study by Priorities USA that has shown that the Project Lincoln ads really didn't help at all in converting any Republicans. They did probably, however, pave the way, smooth the runway, as it were, for a lot of these Never Trumper Republicans to find new sinecures, whether it was on like maybe on cable television networks or other places.
Or literally enriching them, that too.
Yes. I don't mind help from former opponents, but these people own the Republican Party. Stuart Stevens owns some of that. But I think they warrant our skepticism. Here is that interview. It's been cut for time, incidentally. Check it out. Hey, this New Year's Day episode is brought to you by Magic Spoon. So probably wasn't my breakfast. Folks, the new year, we're all trying to eat better. Healthy breakfast does not have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. This is the cereal company that figured out a way to recreate your favorite childhood cereals with zero sugar, 11 grams of protein, only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. You will love this cereal. Your kids actually will love this cereal. I have now, like, I don't know. It's been a long time since I, A, sort of enjoyed eating cereal, and then B, like, was compelled to do it all the time. And now I'm, like, substituting all sorts of meals and midnight snacks. And because many of you asked, now you can finally build your very own custom variety box. You can choose from the best-selling cocoa. They got fruity, frosted, blueberry flavors, plus the brand new flavors, including peanut butter and cinnamon. Cinnamon being my absolute favorite. Peanut butter comes in second, although it is sort of tied with the cocoa. That's a little bit difficult for me to decide. But nevertheless, cinnamon's my go-to. It tastes amazing. Honestly, too good to be true. It's keto-friendly, it's gluten-free, it's grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. But again, zero sugar. Zero sugar. Check it out. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Grab a variety pack. Try it today. Be sure to use our promo code MajorityReport at checkout. You will save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they refund your money, no questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Use the code MajorityReport. You will save $5 off. Thank Magic Spoon for sponsoring the podcast, and thank you for my favorite breakfast. Folks, hectic times. Gonna get more hectic, I imagine, this year. But if you want to sit down, you want to learn something new, or you want to learn something as you're not sitting down, my recommendation is an app called Blinkist. Blinkist is for anybody who wants to learn something they don't know, but they don't have a lot of time. I would suspect that means most of you. It takes the key ideas and insights from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers. This is across over 25 categories. It gathers them together in 15 minutes, either text or audio explainers, or what they call blinks. Use the blinks to get into a topic quickly. And you can find new topics to grow from. You figure out which books you want to spend more time reading or listening to more deeply. They're like cliff notes. Cliff notes for all of those books that maybe you're not sure you want to read, but you want to get the key takeaways. Or maybe you're thinking, like, maybe I do want to read it. This is my way of trying it out. Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcast creators to blink those for you, too, so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories like self-improvement, management, mindfulness, and more. For me, I've explained this in the past, but I like Blinkist because there are books out there that I feel like I should read, and I don't necessarily want to, but I really get a notion of what they're about. I can do that in 15 minutes. I can do it when I'm walking to work, listening, or maybe when I'm waiting for Saul to go to sleep. I sit down, I read it in 15 minutes. He falls asleep. I've learned something that I didn't know before. Also, there's another category of books that, frankly, like, I would never read, and I have no interest in reading, but some of the key takeaways, things like self-improvement, you know, like, how do I become less irritable, or how do I become more efficient, or how do I get people to like me? Plus, you can use Blinkist Shortcast to quickly catch up on podcast episodes that you've missed. So, for instance, maybe you want to check out The Barefoot Investor by Scott Pape. Not necessarily something that you would read, but you want to get the key. What is that about? I don't know. That's weird. I have never heard of that. But for me, Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. Also one of those books that I feel like I should know, but I don't necessarily want to read the whole thing. Blowout by Rachel Maddow. They have all sorts of books like that. And right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/MajorityReport. Start your 7-day free trial. Get 25% off of Blinkist Premium Membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/MajorityReport to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/MajorityReport. Lastly, new sponsor this year, and I'm psyched that they're here. Look, you're setting your New Year's resolution. You want to do a little bit more healthy snacking? Well, this episode is sponsored by Monk Pack. They make snacks that taste like our favorite sugary treats, but with 1 gram of sugar or less. Monk Pack Keto Granola Bars contains 2 grams of net carbs. They're only 140 calories. Plus, they come in delicious flavors like peanut butter dark chocolate. These are my favorite ones. Almond butter cocoa chip. Pumpkin seed cinnamon almond. They come in maple pecan. They're keto friendly. They're gluten free. They're grain free. They're plant based. And they're non-GMO. So I'm supposed to talk about my favorite flavor, but I really actually have three favorite flavors. Almond butter cocoa chip, peanut butter dark chocolate, and pumpkin seed cinnamon almond. They all taste fantastic. My kids love them. To be able to carry around snacks for the kids that they're going to eat, particularly Saul, and know that I'm not feeding him something sugary, but stuff where I'm giving him a ton of protein. I can't even tell you. It's worth its weight in gold, but these things are delicious. 140 calories, 140 calories, 2 net carbs, 5 grams of protein. That's how I get through the second half of the show, folks. Try it for yourself, and you'll see. We have a special deal for our listeners. You get 20% off your first purchase of any Monk Pack product by visiting monkpack.com, entering our code MajorityReport at checkout. Monk Pack is so confident in their product, it is backed with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll exchange the product or refund your money, whichever you prefer. To get started, just go to monkpack.com. That's monkpack, MUNKPACK.com. Select any product, then enter the code MajorityReport at checkout. You will save 20% off your purchase. Monk Pack, delicious, nutritious food you can count on. We thank them for sponsoring this podcast and for helping me find something that is healthy and not full of sugar. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Stuart Stevens, a author of It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Well, great to be here, man.
I should also say you're a, I don't know, former Republican strategist. Do you consider yourself a former Republican strategist or a
I consider myself former.
Former?
Okay. I turned in my union card.
You turned in your, what, is there really a union for Republican? I didn't think so. So, all right, let's start with this. Because I got to tell you, like, you know, I think you probably had a lot of interviews where people have been a little bit skeptical about, you know, the Never Trumpers and to a certain extent, the Lincoln Project. So why did you write the book?
Great question. It goes back to 2016. You know, a lot of people were wrong about Donald Trump, but it's really hard to find somebody who was more wrong than me. I didn't think he'd win the primary. I didn't think he'd win the general. And in retrospect, it was because I didn't want to admit to myself what that meant about the Republican Party. And then I went through a period after he won, kind of like a lot of my friends, saying, well, you know, this isn't really the Republican Party. He hijacked it. But I really don't know how to sustain that. I mean, he's head of the Republican Party. Republican Party is the party that endorsed Roy Moore and attacked John Bolton. So I started asking myself, how did this happen?
What was, in the course of writing the book, what was like the main, what was the primary realization that you came upon? And what were the sort of, I guess, the
emotional, intellectual building blocks that made you come to that conclusion?
Well, I was fascinated by the whole history of this tension in the Republican Party that dates from World War II. I mean, it really goes back to the Eisenhower wing, which is kind of a sane, governing, boring wing, and the Joe McCarthy wing, which was insane. You know, if Fox News had been around, Joe McCarthy was there, he would have been their darling. He would have had his own show. And how that played out. And I always thought that our side of the party, call it, you know, that side that was a governing side, that was a sane side, was the dominant gene. I worked in a lot of campaigns. I went down to Austin in April of 99 to work for George Bush. And, you know, at that time, you could look at conservatism and say a lot of it was sort of a victim of its own success. Cold War was over. I guess we'd won. Welfare was a big issue with conservatives, and Bill Clinton instituted welfare reform. There was a whole crime was going down. Taxes were certainly down from 70% that they once were. So I think Governor Bush and others looked at sort of what is a new construct of conservatism. And that out of that came compassionate conservatism, that idea. And, you know, if you remember at the time, Bush got a lot of criticism from a lot of conservatives saying, are you saying by calling it compassionate conservatism that conservatism hasn't been compassionate? And Bush's answer to that pretty much was, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And for him, the access to that was education. No Child Left Behind, you know, signed with Ted Kennedy over his right shoulder. But then that's probably died on 9/11 when he became a wartime president.
So wait, so I want to circle back to that because I'm curious as to why. I mean, I'm not sure I buy the premise, frankly, but if I did, I'm not sure I understand why annihilate. But I get you're saying that there may not have been issues necessarily for them to run on after Bill Clinton had basically triangulated and taken a lot of space up, particularly of moderate Republicans. Many people refer to Bill Clinton as the best Republican president we've had in some respects. But clearly, the things that you're talking about in this book pre-existed that era, right? I get your metaphor about the dominant gene, but what doesn't happen in the context of passing on genes is that one gene leverages another gene knowingly, right? Because I think in the book you allude to at least some awareness that dominant, whichever one was dominant or submissive, the relationship between them was not like genes. The relationship was like leverage and a tool.
Look, I think the Republican Party had a dark side and a side that was very optimistic and aspirational. I don't think it was ever perfect. I never thought that. But if you really think about what were sort of the basic principles that most people in the dark ages, say 4 years ago, would have agreed the Republican Party stood for. It would have been character counts, personal responsibility, free trade, pro-legal immigration. I mean, Ronald Reagan announced in front of the Statue of Liberty, signed a bill that made everybody in the country before 1983 legal, stronger on Russia. And now the party's not just drift away from those things, it's actively against those things. So, you know, when I wrote this book, there's a sort of trope of books about Washington, if only they had listened to me. Like John Bolton just wrote one of those. Right. I didn't want to write that book because they did listen to me. And I think if one of the reasons I was really drawn to the Republican Party is this concept of personal responsibility, it seems important to take personal responsibility as moving forward and trying to analyze it. So that's why in the beginning of this book, I say, blame me. I mean, I was part of this.
I'm okay to blame you. I mean, but I'm just curious. You share the blame with a lot of people as far as I'm concerned, but let's talk about some of those principles. I'm just curious about even those, because what does personal responsibility mean? Like, I mean, obviously you're saying blame me. Okay, fair enough. But what is that as a political concept?
Well, let's take Donald Trump for example, right? Nothing that happens in Donald Trump's life is his fault. And he will take responsibility for nothing. So the opposite of that is a concept of personal responsibility, that if I go out and I commit a crime, that is an individual decision. It is not a societal decision. It is I have free will here, that this is a choice that I make, and that there is a good and there is an evil. And there are societal elements in it, but ultimately that choice is mine. So it really is sort of like an empowerment of the individual. If you are a person who treats others badly, if you're mean, if you're cruel, that there are always reasons for that. You can justify it, but ultimately that responsibility is on you. And now that I think that breaks down in a governing sense. You have to be very careful about that because there are large societal efforts here. And I think where conservatives went wrong, and I write about this, was looking at sort of systematic poverty and trying to say if only individuals worked harder or something, they have the ability to lift themselves out of poverty, which I think is really where that breaks down.
Where does it work? Because Donald Trump wasn't around when these principles that you're talking about were operative, right? And when they were deployed against, I guess, I don't know, liberals or Democrats or whatever it was the opposition was called at that time. And so I don't understand, like, if it doesn't apply to poverty, and you mentioned education with George Bush, I'm not a fan of that, despite the fact that Ted Kennedy sent. I thought that whole, and I didn't like the follow-up with Obama either, but I'll stipulate that it was in reaction to feeling that education is important and we don't want to, you know, soft bigotry, et cetera, et cetera. But where does, like, because it, to me, the whole personal responsibility thing also sounds like a lie. Like, where does that get deployed? I mean, yes, if you commit a crime, you gotta do the time. But this whole thing of, like, personal responsibility was deployed when Paul Ryan, I know you were a campaign manager for Mitt Romney, you know, made up a story about brown bagging lunches and that kids shouldn't get free lunches because they feel better about having a brown bag lunch. Well, that's fine, but that's nonsense. That's not the issue here. The issue is that the kids don't have the opportunity to eat, but personal responsibility comes into all this. Like, when was it not a lie?
Oh, listen, I think that there was a, if you go back, say, just focus on the issue of crime, right? There was a sort of philosophy that individuals really should not be held accountable, that there were larger societal forces at work that took away this concept of free will for them to commit crime. And I think that's wrong. And I think that if you go to Bill Clinton, I mean, Bill Clinton really ran as sort of a reformist on that. I mean, he was the one, you know, when he ran as a different kind of Democrat, that he was saying that we should hold people responsible. He's the one who hired 100,000 new cops on the street. I mean, in many ways, sort of fascinating that the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign was running against the 1992 Bill Clinton campaign, which I actually look as a very positive sign for the Democratic Party, because I think parties need to change like that and grow. So look, I think that these character counts. So if you go back and you read the stuff that William Bennett wrote about Bill Clinton in the late 90s, and the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, he wrote this beautiful stuff about how character is the soul of the nation and how the president is more important than one set of issues and another set of issues. We really need to hold that. Well, I believed all that, you know? I mean, I worked for Bob Dole. I don't see why it doesn't apply to Donald Trump. It just boggles my mind that you could believe that then and not believe it now.
Oh, so, you're talking about in terms of Republicans. Well, I mean, to be fair, Bennett, meanwhile, also had a massive gambling problem and was using it to pay off Dominatrix, which, you know, I'm not kink shaming anybody, but I'm just saying that, like, he's not in a position to be talking about, you know, sexual picadilly. I mean, he was lying. He was lying, too. He didn't believe any of that in the first place anyways. And everybody knew it at the time, right? I mean, I knew it in 2004, and I would bet that you, because you're an insider, you knew that back in the 90s. So I guess my question is what changed other than you found yourself, like, look, Donald Trump is a repugnant human being. And even if he's doing all the proposals that Mitt Romney would have done, the tax cuts, right? The self-deportation, which is what the whole, you know, separating of the children was. Maybe Romney wouldn't have done that exact same policy, but the idea was similar.
You're wrong about that. Actually.
Well, self-deportation is an existing term of art, which means make things so hostile here that immigrants go back. Was a complete turnaround from...
Let me get into that. If you look at the debate that occurred in, Romney was arguing against forced deportation. And there, in that debate, people were arguing that what we need to do was round these people up. And Romney said, no, what we need to do is we need to make the circumstances in their home country better so that they don't want to come to America. And we want people to leave on their own, which is basically the Obama policy, though Obama deported a lot of people, so that they voluntarily will leave. And he came up with this sort of awkward, weird phrase, self-deportation. But
he didn't coin that. I mean, that was a term of art.
I'd never heard it before.
Okay.
But look, you know, I go back to this. It's not just about policy, right? So you take George Bush after 9/11, right? Iraq War was a disaster. There's no need for us to argue with that. But the way that he responded to say that we should not attack Muslims.
Right.
That's really important. And you think, and so these things matter. And it's not just, well, he would have had the same policy and they would have had, you know, the same policy maybe that Donald Trump would have invaded Iraq. But the quality of human being matters. And, you know, one of the things that...
Let me ask you this, because this is another thing that I struggle with, because I think there's some truth to what you're saying, but I don't know what's in Mitt Romney's heart one way or another about immigration, but I suspect that, you know, Ronald Reagan at one point was for open borders with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned at the beginning of this, he gave amnesty to, I think, 3 or 4 million immigrants. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney was reacting to all of those people in the party, the Republican Party, that, and you know this, you worked for Bush 2004 or five. They tried to, maybe it was 2003. I can't remember exactly. They tried to push immigration reform and they got the Republican Party. They were so out of step with the Republican Party. He got slammed. That was the beginning of the end of his administration, as far as I can tell. So it was quite clear in the aughts where the power was, at least on this issue, within the Republican Party, right? It's not a function. It's only a function of the leader if they are pushing back against the worst inclinations of their people. You know, and like I say, Mitt Romney, I'm sure he's a nice guy. My whole thing is I try not to be friends or know anybody I can possibly know in politics, so I don't really assess them.
Can I just say something? It's a little bit condescending to say he's a nice guy.
Well, okay.
Because
I don't.
Because if ever we've had a lesson that character matters and the quality of the person matters, it's right now. So
fair enough.
Mitt Romney stood up to Trump, that he called out Trump in April. It's more than just being nice. He's actually been courageous about this, that he would vote, be the only person in his party that would vote for impeachment. So I think that
In Utah?
Trump is going to win Utah by 10 points.
I understand, but that's different than saying he's got that, you know, he's not the highest favorability in Utah. I'm saying that, yes, okay. I mean, the courageous seems like a strong. Let me a couple of things that I remember about the 2012 election. Okay. I remember that secret tape from the donors thing,
right.
And everybody remembers the 47%, right? That was where he said, there are 47% of people out there who are not paying any taxes. He was referring to federal income taxes. Of course, they're paying wage, you know, the payroll taxes, and they're paying sales taxes. And so, but he was talking, he didn't specify income, but he just said they're not paying taxes. And he got right into the maker taker divide. And I mean, I don't know if that's an indication of personal responsibility. I mean, what did you see when you were working on that campaign?
Are you really trying to suggest that Mitt Romney is not a man of character?
I like I say, I stipulated. If you want me to say, I'm sure he's a man of character. I'm no, but
you stipulated he was nice. Melania Trump is nice, probably.
Is she? I don't know. I'm okay, but okay. If you want to say that he's a man of character,
this is where I think we get into trouble. Okay, where I think we get into trouble is when we look at this so much through a partisan divide that when you see someone like Mitt Romney, who has stood up to Donald Trump, there's absolutely when Mitt Romney went out there in April, was it, of 16, and stood up to Donald Trump, expecting others in the Republican Party to follow him, or maybe they wouldn't do it. There was absolutely no upside for him to do that, and he did. And when he went out and he voted for impeachment, and when he called out, when he marched in Black Lives Matter,
I don't want to get into an argument about whether he's a man of character or not. I'm just curious as to how elastic that is. Let's stipulate he's a man of character. Like I say, I don't know him. You know him, but I'm talking about in that tape. The thing that got lost in that tape that always struck me. Because you mentioned personal responsibility, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but he said, had he been born of Mexican parents, talking about his dad, mm-hmm. I'd have a better shot at winning this.
Sure, that's a fact. Are you arguing about that?
Yeah.
Why?
Because had his last name been Ramirez, his dad wouldn't have been governor of Michigan. His dad wouldn't have been president of AMC.
Maybe.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
I'm sorry. You think that Romney's dad, also another man of great character,
right,
would have been governor of Michigan in the 50s or the 60s, had he been of Mexican descent?
It's an unprovable.
It is an unprovable.
I don't know. What is your point?
My point is, though, this is a guy who's sitting there saying the implication here is that you get a leg up in this society. If my last name was removed,
that's total bullshit. What he's saying is, Hispanics are, if you just step back, Hispanics are an increasing percentage of the population, right? America's becoming, George Bush got over 40%. That one of the failures of the Republican Party is appealing to Hispanics. And that Republican Party in California in third place now, largely because of the aftermath of what happened in 1994 when Pete Wilson responded negatively. Right. As opposed, interestingly, to Texas, where George Bush was governor, and they took a completely different attitude toward it.
He had better policies towards
not the only reason,
Latinos, yes.
It's also the difference in Tex-Mex culture.
Sure.
But so if Mitt Romney's last name, if he came from Hispanic parents, it's arguable, I think, in just a poli-sci sense, that his appeal to Hispanic voters could have been greater.
But here's my sense. No, it does make sense. But here's my issue with that. It completely erases where he was positioned in life because of A, what his father had achieved, but also because of, frankly, his father would not have achieved that. Had his name been Ramirez, he would not have been president of American Motors. He wouldn't have been any of those things because of the nature of our society. And so this is the canard that I think I'm sort of fascinated about this notion of personal responsibility. That's the complete opposite of personal responsibility, isn't it? It's like, because personal responsibility also means taking stock of what I have that isn't necessarily a function of anything other than pure luck.
Yeah. Listen, if you go back and you read what Mitt Romney has said about this, one of the criticisms he got was not talking about how wealthy he was, how he had made money. And he refused to do that. And a lot of people said, like in debates and things, like, you shouldn't apologize for the fact that you're wealthy. I mean, you went out, you started this business with a couple of guys, you made a lot of money. He didn't inherit money. He inherited every advantage in life. He inherited which he said before, but he didn't inherit money.
Well, I remember a comment where he was talking about they were living in the basement in I think it was Somerville or Cambridge, and all they had to live on was like $40,000 or $50,000 worth of stocks.
No,
well, I remember that. I mean, no, that was a quote. So, I mean, I know it was a quote.
But he wouldn't do that because his whole thing was: are you saying that people should vote for me because I was lucky enough to make a lot of money? And a lot of it is luck. That makes me a better person because I'm wealthy. I mean, that is completely against every sort of article of faith and values that he was taught. And he never would do it. It was really, I mean, we'd sit around and debate prep. And I can remember Tim Pawlenty, who was he's a great guy. He was governor of Minnesota. He would just say, like, man, this isn't complicated. Don't be defensive about it. Be proud of the fact you made a lot of money. And Mitt would push back in this way and say, so that makes me a better person. So you should vote for me.
Was that in the primary?
Well, and in the general, too. Look, you should vote for me.
Newt Gingrich took a big chunk out of him.
I should make a lot of money because I made a lot of money. I'm a better person.
Right.
Well, really?
Newt Gingrich. Well, but isn't, I mean, that was actually, I mean, that was built into a lot of the Republican ideology at that time. I mean, and for years, right? That poverty is in some way a moral failure. I mean, let me put it this way. When Donald Trump came along.
I don't think that you would call that a Republican. I think that you would call it larger than that.
Oh,
I'll tell you something. I think you would have to call it American. To try to just call that Republican would be, I can tell you, frankly, childish.
Within conservative circles, the idea that money is not a moral righteous indicator and that poverty is not. I mean, all of that personal responsibility stuff really dovetails a lot with it.
I will tell you
that on the day Donald Trump ran for office, I know exactly where I was. I walked into MSNBC and I told everybody he is going to win the primary because they have been building, the Republican Party has been stitching a suit for years and he fits it. Mm-hmm. And he's going to get on that stage. And there's literally countless hours. I am more money than all of you. I am better than you, period, end of story. And every single Republican is going to buy it because that's what they've been taught for years. That if I have achieved this level of business success, then I have some measure of moral righteousness. You don't hear, Democrats leftists promote that
Sure you do. Sure.
Tell.
You think Kennedy would have been president if he had been poor? Do you think Roosevelt would have been president if he was poor?
Absolutely not. I think they used their money for this. Absolutely. But you
don't think that people looked at them as successful?
I'm talking about their policies, though. See, I'm talking about their policies. And, you know, when Paul Ryan says that kid wants the brown bag sent lunch, it's better for them.
Look, I'm not here. I like Paul Ryan. I think Paul Ryan's a very good person. I'm not here to defend Paul Ryan.
Well, I'm not asking to defend Paul Ryan. I'm using him as an example of a Republican ideology. You'd never heard Tip O'Neill talk like that. You never heard.
No, but I've heard. Listen, there are countless millionaire Democrat candidates out there for governor, who run for the Senate. John Watt Brown, who got elected in Kentucky, who ran on the fact that he was a millionaire, that he had been very successful in business. This is not a Republican.
In Kentucky, it's a red state. I mean, I'm sure.
But he was a Democrat. What I'm trying to say is, it's simply wrong. And there's a larger indictment to be made here that I think you would agree with. It is wrong to say that the division in this as a value falls just between Democrat and Republicans, and that being a Democrat isolates you from this this view. It's something that is part of American society. And I think there's good things about it in some ways. I think the aspirational qualities of it are good. They're good parts of it. Where it's negative is when we don't recognize the large societal forces that make it difficult for people to succeed. And the fundamental problem, and I write about this in the Republican Party, and I write about this in the book is, you know, there was the Ronald Reagan thing that we all thought was funny, but summed up a philosophy. You know, the most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm here from the federal government to help. So how do you square that, which is sort of a way to talk about smaller government and how government screws up things. And we all thought it was funny and true. how do you square that? Hold on. How do you square that with, say, the moment we're in now, where the federal government is what has to save us from this pandemic? How do you square that with the large number of people in the country on the lower economic spectrum that see the federal government as one of their essential tools to rise in life? So what the point I make in this book, if you've actually read the book, is when Republicans failed to attract African Americans, there was a fault in the Republican Party by saying we just didn't know how to communicate with African Americans. And there was a whole cottage industry of African Americans.
How to talk to African Americans, yes.
Where it was a failure to acknowledge it was our policies that I think African Americans understood us completely well. And they didn't see what was being offered by the Republicans as helping them in their lives, to put it in a very simple way. And that is the failure of it. And it's something that we've never addressed as a party. And it's a continuing failure of the party. And it's,
I think you would argue that they did the opposite, right? I mean, because small government may have been, you know, to some people been like, you know, government's a waste, it's bureaucracy. But to a lot of people, what it meant was what Reagan meant when he went down to Neshoba County, the Neshoba County Fair, and for his general election announced that, you know, with a bunch of Confederate flags behind him, this is about state rights. We know what state rights means, right? I mean, that's right. I mean, like.
So you're asking me to defend Reagan?
No. I'm not asking you to defend Reagan. I guess I'm still trying to get at this.
About that for a second? Because it's an interesting point. Okay. So I'm a seventh generation Mississippian. I grew up going to the Shelby County Fair. And for years I defended Reagan for going there, because Mississippi was a swing state. Carter carried it. We forget that, you know. And it was important for him to carry. And politicians go to Neshoba County all the time.
Of course.
I mean, you know, the most, what passes for liberal Democrats in Mississippi at the time, I mean, everybody goes to Neshoba County Fair. So I defended it for years. But when I was writing this book, I went back and I reread the speech. And I think what he didn't say is very important. And I think that it was a failure. And I write about that. And I think it's part of how I see it differently now than I did then. And he should have. He should have acknowledged it. To be that close to where Shorna Cheney and Goodman were buried and not to talk about it was a failure. But
do you think it was just an omission, or do you think it was a conscious effort? That to me does not seem like he should have mentioned it. It seems to me like he purposely was mentioning something else, that either by omission or by talking about states' rights. Now, maybe I'm jaded and I'm cynical about it, but
where
I'm just curious.
Down, though, you know, where it kind of breaks down is if you look at the Democratic, you know, when Jimmy Carter came to Mississippi, he didn't talk about Shorna Cheney. And it's interesting.
Did he talk about states' rights, though?
Well, actually, probably he did. Carter would do that kind of thing. But it I think it's a failure.
Did you know about Lee Atwater's perspective on this?
Listen, I wrote a whole chapter on this. You know, I'm the guy that said race was the original sin of the Republican Party. So don't argue with me with this. Okay?
No, I know.
Let me just say this. I think as a society, we are in a very different place in our recognition of the civil rights era. The larger issue to me is the whole way in which the Civil War was cast, the whole lost cause, and that culture. I mean, I very much grew up in that. And I grew up in a family that was, you know, there's a phrase in Mississippi that was used a lot, you know, good on race or bad on race. So I grew up in a family that was very moderate on race. And in fact, I'm writing a novel now about white civil rights workers, because when I was a kid, my mother had this way of collecting people. And our basement was always filled with these white civil rights workers who were coming down from the north. And they were kind of these mythic figures to me, you know. But we still were part of that lost cause. I mean, it's just, I think Donald Trump's whole view of where society is now is wrong. I mean, these take your average teenager living in the Mississippi, you know, white teenager. He'd a lot rather be a black rap star than Robert E. Lee. I mean, that whole world is just past. And I think his whole view of suburbs, you're talking about suburban women. I don't think people in the suburbs, they don't want their kids to think that if someone who is of a different religion or race moves next door, that they're not going to be reach out to them in kindness. I think he's
knock on wood. But he does know where the Republican Party is, right? I mean, that's why, I mean, let me ask you this. If Donald Trump doesn't know the Republican Party, the voters, then listen, why is every politician afraid to buck him?
I wrote a book that said Donald Trump is the Republican Party. So we have no argument over this.
Right, okay.
I think my premise is that Donald Trump didn't hijack the Republican Party, that the Republican Party became Donald Trump. So, and look, I'm the guy waking up every day in the Lincoln Project trying to beat these people. So,
let's talk about the Lincoln Project a little bit.
I mean, I spent 30 plus years pointing out flaws in the Democratic Party. So I've got plenty of credentials there. But what I've said is that I will work in the Democratic Party because I think that really the Democratic Party represents what is going to be the future of America. Because there's really three parties in America now, I see. You know, there's Republican Party, which is increasingly irrelevant and says no. And there's really kind of two parties inside the Democratic Party, an AOC party or Bernie Sanders and say a Joe Biden. And the result of that fight, debate, whatever, is going to decide the future of our policy. I mean, in 20 years, are we still going to be the only country that doesn't have national health insurance in Western democracy? Of course not. What that's going to be isn't going to be decided in the Republican Party. I mean, they've had a chance and they've already said no. So that to me is what it is. So I see the Republican Party as becoming, I look at California as the future of the Republican Party. So look,
interviewed Jean Guerrero, who wrote a book about Stephen Miller and made that exact same point that she thinks. But what you just said before that is actually the biggest concern I have with the Lincoln Project. And it's funny that the Lincoln Project came up so close into that notion of you working in the Democratic Party and of this divide that you see in the Democratic Party, because that's actually, for me, the reason why I wanted to sit down with you, because from my perspective, that's the biggest issue I have with the Lincoln Project, is that I'm not clear what the Lincoln Project is really about. And I think to a certain extent, your perspective gives a little bit of a hint, which is, this is about defeating Donald Trump, A, priority number one, no doubt, because it has to happen both sequentially and in terms of, I think, you know, for a whole host of other reasons. But there's a B there that I think people, Democrats, people on the left should be very aware of, which is, if they're like you, maybe they aren't. I don't know them. They see the future in the Democratic Party. And it's time for us to weigh in and stop and define where the Democratic Party goes. And so I see stuff on the Lincoln.
First of all, you know, I can't speak for the Lincoln Project. And
you work with it, but what do you?
I'm working with them, but I think each individual involved in the Lincoln Project, if you sat down, would have variations of different answers to this question, you know, because really it's a little bit like asking somebody about are you worried about your cholesterol count in a knife fight? It's like, well, yeah, I am, but I'm like more important than in a knife fight. So I think these are great questions for November 4th, November 5th, November 6th. Look, we're people that works in the Republican Party, right? And we have certain skills. So we had sort of three choices in this. We could either support Donald Trump, that's not going to happen. Or we could have set it out. Or we could work to defeat Donald Trump. So that's what we're doing. And we don't confuse ourselves with trying to save the nation, or, you know, we don't see ourselves as personally heroic. we're just like men and women. They just kind of know how to do some stuff.
You're a mercenary on some level. It's a mercenary thing.
No,
right? I mean, you have a skill set.
It's not a mercenary thing because we'd be making a fortune working for Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, if at this point, I mean.
You know Donald Trump. He's the most transactional person on the planet. Right?
I know that.
If I went on television, I've often even thought of doing this as an experiment, but if I went on television for 3 weeks and wrote pieces saying, look, I was wrong about Donald Trump. I finally get it. At the end of that 3 weeks, I could be running the Donald Trump campaign.
Okay, well, then let me put it this way. You in particular, I think, of the people in the Lincoln Project, there may be others who are similarly situated. You have a skill set, right? You're a samurai, and you have a skill set, and it's not necessarily, you do have some measure of a code. It's not just about money, but there are other people in there who are political strategists. And it's funny because I critiqued a Lincoln Project ad or a tweet at one point, and somebody tweeted back to me, they're trying to get Donald Trump, the defeated. And I just don't think they're that calculating that they're also trying to position themselves in the coalition that defeats him so that they have a seat at the table. I'm expanding on what, but that was my point. And for me, when I look at a cadre of political strategists and I think, are they calculating? I think they're the most calculating human beings on the planet. They're literally paid to. They're successful because they are trying to look two or three steps down the road, that we're setting up legislation in September of 2017 to pass in December of 2019. I mean, that's what political strategists do. They push here and they expect an impact, you know, down the road. And so for me to assume that nobody in the Lincoln Project is thinking, we're going to raise money, we're going to appeal to the left and to Democrats, because look, I appreciate the work you're doing. I'm not convinced there's a constituency there for it. The ads are good. That's all well and good, but none of it's on policy. And I'm quite convinced that, like, I mean, this referendum might work against Donald Trump, might not. But there's a lot of reasons.
That's not true, by the way, that the ads aren't on policy. Look, what is by far the number one issue in the country? The economy. There are more Americans out of work this August than any August in the history of the country. More Americans have died of a disease in the last 5 months than have ever died before in the history of the country. That's policy.
Oh, no, I agree.
You have a confluence of uniquely deadly circumstances here. This increase of anti-science attitude in the Republican Party that merges with this anti-elite part of the Republican Party, which is completely phony, which merges with this anti-big government. And it's a sort of toxic, perfect storm that has killed tens and thousands of Americans, which has ruined our economy, which is destroying the fabric of American life. When your kid can't go to school, when you lose your job because you have to stay home to take care of your kid because there's not daycare because no one will do that. That's policy. That's incompetent government. Now, part of that is character. Donald Trump is a gangster, and he runs the government like a gangster operation. You know, the person in charge of COVID is the person who's sleeping with his daughter. That's how gangsters operate, and who tried to set up his own friends. So these are the big policy issues of our time, right?
I would agree.
Yeah, and so look, I think it's a fair question to ask. So are the political consultants in the Biden campaign plotting to take over the Democratic Party? It's kind of, listen, let me tell you something.
In the Biden campaign?
Yeah, I mean, are they going to try to kill the AOC wing? I don't think so.
There is no doubt in my mind that the political at least a percentage of the political operatives in the Biden campaign are definitely trying to fend off the AOC wing of the party. Of course.
And do you think that that's why they're for Biden? That they're not trying to just beat Trump? That they're trying to do something good for the country?
Oh, the people on the Biden campaign? Well, I think many of those people are hoping to have influence in a Biden administration. I don't think their only goal is to defeat the AOC wing of the party. But of course, I know people who work on campaigns. They're contemplating working in administrations.
Well, listen, I did this for 30 years. I elected more Republicans than anybody else out there. Presidents here, abroad. I never worked in administration. I never wanted to. I never thought that I'd be good.
Well, no, I mean, I think, listen, I'm talking about the Lincoln Project. And like you say, you can't talk for other people. But, you know, Bill Kristol, others, they want to have influence. They can have influence by writing in a magazine. They can have influence because they've built a constituency.
What's your point?
Oh, my point is that I think people on the left should be very skeptical of the Lincoln Project. I'm okay with what you guys are doing, obviously, defeat Donald Trump.
We live in a binary world, okay? We're either going to be for Trump or against Trump. You agree we should be against Trump?
Totally.
Okay, second question. Do you think we should try to use our skills that we have to defeat Trump?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so we're agreed on that. Okay, that's all that matters right now, because that's all we're doing. There's not some giant conspiracy out there, you know.
I don't think it has to be a giant conspiracy.
There's not even a little conspiracy. There's not even that. Wait a second.
Let me ask you this. Can you tell me why Bill Kristol's doing this?
I think Bill Kristol is doing this because I think that he's a guy.
But you don't know.
No, hold on a second. You asked my opinion. Okay. You're right. I don't know, but I can give you my opinion.
Okay.
I think he's a guy who's 60-something. Who spent his life working for something that he believed in, that he thought was going to come to a greater good, who looks at it and is appalled at sort of what we have wrought. And I think that he sees that the conservative movement failed. I think he sees on multiple levels. I think he sees that what he thought was going to happen didn't happen, and it sickens him. So it's really had an impact on his life. You know, he's lost a lot of friends. He lost his magazine. Weekly Standard was shut down because they wouldn't support Trump. He paid, a serious price in that sense. I think he's appalled. I think he's saddened. And I think he wants the country to be rid of Trump. And I think that he and I probably have a difference when it comes to the Susan Collins of the world and Cory Gardner's. And I can debate that round or flat, but I know where I am. But I think that's it. I don't think it's really that complicated. I think
Steve Schmidt.
Oh, I know where Steve. I talked to Steve, talking to him 10 minutes ago. Steve says thinks this is a national crisis. He thinks that this is the greatest threat to the country since the Civil War. And I actually agree with Steve on this. I think the next 60 days are the
I
most
I was worried about Howard Schultz, I got to tell you, though.
The most dangerous.
That was a cash situation.
The most dangerous period, I think, that we've had since the Civil War are in the next 60 days.
I agree.
Look,
who does the Lincoln Project, what votes are they moving, do you think?
Oh, our goal is to take 4% of Republicans away from Trump.
What's your sense of how that's going?
It's going well. Yeah.
How many, I mean, can you see in
polling? Here's a perfect example.
Because I don't see it in polling.
Yeah, you see it in polling. Look how much smaller the Republican Party is. Trump.
Oh, but that's not a function of. I mean that. I mean.
Sure, it is. It's a function of something that's happening now. Why it's happening? You never causality in politics.
Right, I understand.
Established, but when you see Trump having these numbers of 90%+ support, and he says 95, he lies about everything. But say it's 88%. It's a much significantly smaller group of people who are identifying themselves as Republicans now, and this is really important. So let me give you a perfect example. Wisconsin. Romney loses Wisconsin by 7. Trump wins Wisconsin by 1. But here's the dirty little secret. Mitt Romney got more votes.
More votes, right.
So, I wrote a piece about this yesterday in the Washington Post, which is why I think what's happening in Wisconsin is very good for Democrats now. Why did Donald Trump win with 46.1 when Romney lost with 47.2? Really for two reasons. Third party vote increased. It doubled over 2012. Well, that's not going to happen again. I think we can all agree.
Right.
And non-white turnout, specifically African-American turnout, declined for the first time in 20 years. So this is a very simple race here. And Republicans understand this. This is why voter suppression is going to be a huge issue in this race, is a huge issue in this race. The country is increasingly becoming less white. Their share of non-white vote is either stagnant or declining. So it's simple math. They, for them to win, they have to reduce the percentage of non-white vote as part of the total electorate. And it's simple math. So I think that we're serving there's a lot of things we're doing. I mean, this morning, Donald Trump attacked us because we put out a spot talking about how his ratings were better than Donald, were worse than Biden's. So what does that mean? Okay, the one thing that every campaign has exact same amount of is time. So today, hours of the Donald Trump campaign are being spent attacking the Lincoln Project. I mean, we wouldn't vote for ourselves. Are you crazy? We're like political consultants. We like laugh at this. It's like, dude, it's insane. And that's a day he's not attacking Joe Biden.
Right.
And that's a good day. And, you know, they go out and they drop this oppo on us and stuff. We just laugh. We don't care. So we know how to get in their heads. We know these people. All these sort of crooks and castoffs around Trump. This isn't, they're working in their first presidential campaigns, not because all of a sudden they woke up and wanted to work in presidential campaigns. They've been trying to get in presidential campaigns for years. I've done five of them. Nobody would hire these people. And like Jason Miller used to be my intern. I wouldn't hire Jason in a million years. So we know how to distract them. And that's a very useful, in war, that's a useful thing, when to create confusion. Nobody in the Lincoln Project wants to work in the Biden administration. We don't want to be ambassadors. We don't want to be, you know, anything. We just want to beat the guy, and we want to beat Trumpism.
And then what happens after you guys do that? Do you go back?
First of all, stop. We're not going to do that, because whatever happens, if Trump loses, you haven't defeated Trumpism. It's still going to continue in the party. And I'll give you a perfect example.
Yes.
There's sort of another Republican Party out there, and that's these popular governors in blue states. Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, Larry Hogan, Phil Scott here in Vermont, where I'm sitting right now. I've worked for all those guys. I love those guys. If the Republican Party had any sense, they'd be studying these guys going, you're selling our product in the hardest market. Like, what can we learn from you? Instead, they kind of treat them with benign neglect. But here's what's really telling. None of those guys can pick their own state party chairman, which is unimaginable in politics. I mean, like, you're a governor, you're popular, you can't pick your own state party chairman. I mean, it would be like saying, like, you know, you couldn't decide what to have for lunch.
Let me just
shows how far Trumpism is in the party.
I just want to illustrate what you're saying for people who don't understand the dynamic. In other words, the Republican parties in these parties, generally the chief executive gets to put that person in the same way that, like, you, if you're president of the United States, you choose who the chairman of the Republican Party is. You put your person in there. They can't do it because the actual Republican Party, not the leadership, middle management and down at the very least in those states, sometimes top management Washington, that's what Republicans are.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm the guy that wrote the book that said that.
I know you're the only one I would have on. I just want you to know that, which I don't know that you're terribly excited about at this point. But I do appreciate you coming on.
I think what's happened now, it's always difficult when you're in the middle of something to kind of realize the impact of it. But I don't think we've seen anything like it. I think we've seen a complete, total moral and philosophical collapse of a major party in America. And really the only thing I can liken it to is the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union, where what the party said it was for and what it actually delivered was so disparate that it just kind of collapsed. So I think there is a market for center-right party in America. But right now, I don't think anyone who's a conservative, Republican, with any credibility can tell you what conservatism is. They can't. What is it? I mean, we're to the left of Bernie Sanders on trade. I mean, Bernie honeymoons in Russia, but, he didn't, like, sleep with Putin. We're incoherent on the issues of character counts and personal responsibility. So, you know, say what you will about Elizabeth Warren. She has a theory of government. She can defend it. She can articulate it. You can argue with it. You can love it. You can hate it. But there's a theory there. And it's logical and it holds together. There's no such thing on the Republican side now. And eventually that will emerge. But I think it's going to, I think we're in for a period of center left government for a good while now. And probably eventually it'll go too far and something will come out of it. But I'll leave you with one statistic, okay? Just so you realize like how you're going to own the future. So you can maybe feel better about this. Americans 15 years and under, the majority are non-white. So the odds are really good they're going to be 18 and non-white. And that is a death sentence for the Republican Party as it is now.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with certainly some of what you say. I sort of had that same opinion of the Republican Party, I don't know, over the past 20 years. But better late than never, I guess. But appreciate your time, Stuart Stevens. It was all a lie how the Republican Party became Donald Trump. Really appreciate your patience your hanging with us. Thank you so much.
Enjoyed it.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care.
So there it is, Emma. People can make their own determination as to, you know, just how sincere and how consistent some of the responses were from Stuart Stevens and all of these Project Lincoln people. I'm glad Donald Trump is not president anymore, but it's not clear to me that they did anything other than rebrand themselves going forward. But ladies and gentlemen, that is the last of our best ofs. We will be back Monday with new live shows on the Majority Report. Folks, have a great weekend, and let's hope 2021 is a significantly better year than 2020.
Yes.
Emma, we'll see you Monday.
Later.